Welcome to Recalculating Small Business.
Dan, we have an absolutely fascinating guest, Dr. Kenyon Meadows. He's a doctor, but he's also very interested in finance. Dr. Meadows, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, sure. Well, first off, I'm a practicing physician. I'm a radiation oncologist. So it means I treat cancer patients with radiation. And as a side interest or enthusiasm of mine is investing. And after starting off learning all I could about stocks and bonds and everything and going through the 2008 financial crisis, I began to think about some other alternative assets to invest in. And that's what led me to start exploring that and led to my first book that I wrote on it.
Well, tell us about the book and your theories.
Okay, well, the name of the book is called Alternative Financial Medicine, and it's basically kind of chronicling my experience investing in alternative assets, which are really anything other than stocks, bonds, and mutual funds and everything. So I started off educating myself as best as I could and started off with real estate investing, and specifically what's called private mortgage lending. And I think most of the audience will be familiar with a lot of the flip these house type shows that are certainly all the rage several years ago and are still on TV. Well, when people go to flip a house, they oftentimes don't go to a traditional bank or financial institution for that. A lot of times they'll come to an individual to get a short-term private loan to do that. And so that was my first foray into alternative investments, which is basically loaning money at very attractive interest rates to house flippers. And from there, that led into starting to buy rental property. And then from there, you know, branched off into other things like real estate crowdfunding and, you know, a bunch of other things that are detailed in the book there.
Well, Dan, I'm going to turn this over to you because this is your area of expertise.
Thank you. Dr. Kenyon, I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been managing money for 44 years in practically every asset class one could invest in. It sounds as if, and I happen to believe that there are good alternatives to stocks and bonds. Not that you should replace all of your stocks and bonds, but for diversification purposes, it's good to have alternative investments. What I found is that in my 44 years, I used to work for a major brokerage firm, one of the biggest, and I left production and I went into New York to run a major product area for that company. And I used to travel around the country doing seminars with our broker's clients. And the first question I usually ask in a seminar, and you can answer the question, doctor, how many of you have an advanced degree? And I would ask for people who had bachelor's, master's, and doctorates. And as you got up the scale of education, the number of courses, the number of people went down. And then I said, in all of the years that all of you went to college to get your advanced degrees, how many course credits did you have in figuring out how to invest the money that your advanced degrees were going to give you? How many did you have, doctor?
You're asking how many would answer that in your seminars?
I'm asking you as a doctor.
Oh,
in your years of higher education, how many credit courses did you have in learning how to figure out how to invest the money that your advanced degree was going to give you?
Zero. Not one iota.
And we don't teach that in college. We don't teach people. High school students or elementary school students about dealing with money. We have no education. And so when people like yourself, doctor, become self-taught, they have to go through a lot of frogs to find the prince that works for them. So I applaud you for taking the courage to go and look at other things. A lot of people, doctor, just don't have the time or the emotional disposition to do what you did. Why did you decide? Was it the crash of 2008 that said there's got to be a better way? What was your motivation?
Well, yeah, I do put a lot of it on the 2008 crash. And, you know, it just so happens with where I was at with getting out of residency in 06 and starting to, you know, earn some substantial income for the first time in my life. You know, I'd always been somewhat, you know, peripherally aware of the stock market and through prior jobs, you know, you have your 401k and everything. But at that point, I'd been able to actually put some substantial money into the market voluntarily. And then when you saw how quickly things could go down, that was kind of jarring to me, right? And it really just highlighted the loss of control. And also, you know, of course, the very long time horizon you have to have with dealing with the stock market. And so while mm-hmm. I still, of course, invest there, I just began to ask myself, you know, could I get the traditional types of returns that the market would promise, you know, the sort of, you know, 8 to 12% a year that's oftentimes quoted, you know, could I get that in a way that was not correlated with the market, you know, maybe could even have an asset behind it, you know, backing whatever investment that was. You know, so that was kind of my thesis in going off and looking at some of this other stuff.
Doctor, I applaud your thought process. You know, I say to people that the 100-year average of the S&P 500 is about 6.5-7%, and of that 6.5-7%. Fully 65% of that total return comes from the dividends that the S&P stocks pay. Mm-hmm. You can go in the market today and you can buy high quality preferred stocks that will pay you the historical return of the S&P 500 without having to take the risk of the S&P 500. So you have diminished volatility and you have predictable cash flow, which then you can reinvest or do something else with it. How did you migrate to the if I understood what you said, the first thing you did was to provide, in essence, capital for people who were going to flip houses. How did you come to that realization?
Well, I literally began to ask around in my network of folks what they did with their money outside of the market. And I happened to run into a gentleman at church who sort of semi-retired and had done well in another career, and he was the one that first told me about it. And when he told me the amounts of interest he was able to charge and how he was able to structure things so that if the loan didn't go well, he had the right to a valuable piece of real estate to protect himself and everything. So that all seemed to appeal to me very much. So it literally was kind of was asking around, and that when I learned just the general gist of it, it led me to delve into it more and really get into the real estate investor community that was around, which I really was oblivious to previously.
So when you do flip financing, you're in it for cash flow, income, not appreciation.
Correct. In the vast majority of cases, I will charge what I feel is an attractive interest rate on the money, maybe 12 or 15%, something like that, sometimes a little higher. In a few cases, I have negotiated a part of the upside on the sale, but honestly, I'm content to charge the interest most of the time.
And what is the typical duration of your loans?
We usually structure them for a year or 18 months. As you know, most house flips, particularly people that do a high volume of them and really know what they're doing, usually they complete well in advance of that. 4 to 6 months is a common time period for the whole thing.
Do you have any penalty for prepayment?
No, I don't. Again, I tend to work with people that do a large volume. And so when a project wraps up, they usually there's another project a lot of times within a week or two where you can redeploy your money. So not a problem.
Have you had any defaults?
On the on the whole loans, when I'm working with somebody that I found myself, no. Now, interestingly, I have been an early adopter in the real estate crowdfunding world, which essentially is real estate investing online, where you can participate on a very fractional basis on a private loan that way through an online site. And while most of those things have worked out, there have been a few defaults there, but the amount of money at risk is a heck of a lot less because it's a crowdfunding thing, so you're only putting in a little sliver. But it hasn't hurt me too much.
When you went into the crowdfunding, were the projected returns in line with what you were doing on your private basis, or were they more?
Initially, they were comparable. I was one of the early adopters in real estate crowdfunding in terms of investors. I got on some platforms right when they came out in 2012 on the heels of the Jobs Act. And back then, I think they had to pay a more attractive rate to attract people to participate. And as more and more people have come into that space and are aware of it, I certainly have seen the interest rates go down that they pay. And like I said, I don't think they have to as much, because I think in a lot of people's eyes, the asset class has been around enough and it's got a little bit of a track record and is viewed as a little safer. That's my theory.
So
anyway.
Are the crowdfunding deals now less attractive to you than what you can do on your own?
They are now, yes. So I've definitely done less.
And are you exploring any other alternatives other than real estate or real estate related?
I did do some of the online lending, the peer-to-peer type things like the Lending Club and Prosper, where you're making unsecured consumer loans to people through these platforms. I did that for a couple of years. I've been into it decently heavy. But honestly, as the real estate, continue to mature and take off, you can make the same returns and be secured as opposed to making unsecured loans to people. But the attractive thing about the Lending Club and the Prosper and everything is that you can participate with very, very small amounts of money. And so, if you had a few hundred bucks sitting around not earning very much of anything in the savings account or a CD, and you didn't need it as part of your reserve, you could easily make 7 or 8% or so loaning it out on those platforms, in my experience.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So are you looking at or have you considered alternatives like oil and gas and precious metals?
Yeah, I own a very, very modest amount of precious metal, a little bit of gold and silver, a tiny, tiny amount. There was a time where I was considering getting into that into a major way, but I think that's more of a nice little insurance kind of thing to have. Oil and gas, not significantly. I own some those MLP partnerships and pipelines and that kind of thing, and that really – those really took a hit in 2012 when oil prices went down. That was probably my main exposure to oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So those other alternatives don't appeal to you as much as what you're doing right now.
Right. Not as much. No.
And so, what is your sense of the continuation, or are you in the same camp as Greenspan, who was concerned about a bubble in real estate again?
Well, I can tell you, so we do buy income property, single-family homes, and I have seen the prices steadily go up to the point where it's difficult for us to buy in the particular city and neighborhood that we were used to. So I have seen things go up, certainly. And so I think that we could be heading that way. The only thing is, they certainly haven't loosened up the lending standards, it seems to me, anywhere near what they have before. So I don't think we're near that level yet.
Do you think, though, that even though they may not have lowered the standards, do you think it's possible that that the leverage that is available See, you're in a sense, you're competing indirectly against the banking institutions who probably wouldn't make the loans anyway, but theoretically, you're competing against a bank to loan the money to do these flip projects. As the inventory, I have a friend who's a client who lives in Fort Worth, who's been doing what you've been doing for a long time, and he's telling me when I spoke to him last weekend that he's very concerned that the prices of rental properties and then properties in general in the Dallas-Fort Worth area are back to higher levels than they were in 2007, early 2008. And he's very concerned that the bubble may pop. Now, we've got an economy which is just going the other direction with GDP expansion and jobs and everything else. So the demand for people who have not been able to buy because they're working and they've got a fatter paycheck. But, you know, it's interesting how devastating the market collapse was, but even more devastating to Americans was the collapse of the housing market at the same time the stock market collapsed, where for many people, their largest single asset literally went underwater if they didn't have their home paid for. You don't see that happening again.
I don't see it to the degree. I don't think it's being driven by the same mechanism. So I don't think it'll be nearly as severe. That's my honest feeling. I think we could reach bubble levels, but I think it'll get there in a much more, I guess, controlled manner. You know, it's hard to predict.
How do you at different parts of the cycle, how do you judge and manage your risk exposure?
Well, say for instance, you know, with respect to the buying of property, which is actually an owning income property, which is really going to be the biggest holding for me. As things start to get more expensive, to the point where rent to value ratios and things of that nature aren't as attractive, for instance, I'll do more of the private lending. I'm still happy to still lend on property that's in an appreciating market and everything, as long as I'm in first position and if need be, I can take that house back and easily liquidate it or foreclose or do what I needed to do on it. So I'm not buying, say, for instance, as much, okay, at inflated prices now. So that's one way to just do more lending, and if things reverse themselves, do more buying when things cool off again.
So you're controlling your risk by cutting back the amount of exposure that you're willing to take.
Correct.
So then, if that's the case, could we assume that at some point you have surplus funds? And what are you doing with those surpluses? Is it staying in the bank or money market fund, or what are you doing with it?
For the first time, it's a unique problem to have at this point. Yeah, I am content, and I'm listening to some mentors of mine, some real estate entrepreneurs that do this all the time. You know, that notion of keeping powder dry on the sideline and not having all your capital deployed and waiting, that's a new thing for me, but something that some of my mentors have said, you know, hey, you have to do that sometime.
How much, as a radiologist, how much time do you have into running your business?
Well, you know, I work full time, and so, you know, 50 hours a week, sometimes a little bit more in terms of the main job, and the investment piece, it's something that I do enjoy, but it has come at the sacrifice of a lot of other pleasurable activities that I used to do. 'Cause I'm not going to sacrifice the family time, but I mean, the TV is gone, you know, other sort of wasteful activities, that's gone now. So it's going full bore, you know, all my free time.
So when you look at where you are today, the amount of time that you spend on your real estate, is it equaling the revenue that you're generating from your medical practice?
Not at this point. That's something that will take another few years to do. But I do view that as, like, that's going to be a significant component of my retirement or decision to maybe eventually go part-time or something along those lines as that cash flow starts to build. That's certainly a primary driver of things.
Okay.
But I really enjoy medicine, so.
So I have one more question, then I'll turn it over to Don. I'm curious about the people that you are providing the funding for the flippers. Are they finding it harder to find houses to flip?
I work with two people primarily. The one that is more geographically limited, yes. The one that's willing to scour what seems to be the whole lower half of the state, no. So, yeah, I think, you know, casting a wider net, that gentleman is still able to find deals routinely.
So when you look at a flip transaction today, how much is it in your decision making process is driven by the relationship you have with the buyer?
At this point, it's 95% of it. So after doing several successful projects and always having a good exit, you know, at this point, it's one of these things where I could just sort of get an email with an address and I just say, yeah, let's do it. And it just sort of happens. But that has had to evolve over the period of a couple of years.
So you're not really involved in a due diligence over the property?
Not anymore. You know, when I first got into it, and again, that's a relationship thing. I used to be much more, but comfort level with working with the same person has made it where it's much easier.
And my last question, are you looking for other flippers to work with?
I'm open to it.
Don, back to you.
Okay.
I've just been listening to Dan. Well, fascinating job. A question for you, which is totally off the wall. Have you ever heard about investing in post offices?
No, I haven't. From what I hear our government's trying to privatize or even get rid of the post office. So I don't know.
No. Apparently, the postal service branch, or they have to move a branch. People buy the building and then lease it back to the postal service. And over the last 5 years, apparently, it has the highest rate of return of any real estate. We knew someone who owned 24 post offices across the country. You know, and I found that fascinating. I was listening to you, and you certainly look at it. Well, Dan, we've been listening to Dr. Kenyon Meadows, and it's a very interesting approach to investment for entrepreneurs.
The program dedicated to American small business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz.
You know, Dan, before we go any further, I want our audience to know about your new runaway hit book on Alzheimer's disease and how it affects teenagers. Please tell us about it.
Yeah, Don, thank you. The book is called Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? It's a book written primarily for children ages 9 to 12, but really needs to be read by the entire family. And what I try to do is I try to take the subject matter of dementia and the challenges to a different level in the form of a mystery story with my two little detectives, two little girls, Hudson and Charlotte. And it really creates a breakthrough opportunity for small children and parents and families to begin to understand the problem with dementia. See, Don, the real challenge is that the children are the forgotten people. Mom and dad spend so much time working to try and take care of mom and dad, they don't take the time to explain to the children what's going on in grandma or grandpa's brain. So you can buy it at Amazon.com, or you can order it through your local bookstore, or any online bookstore besides Amazon has it available. Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? Illustrations are spectacular. A story by Dan Perkins.
Your runaway bestseller, new book.
Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? By Dan Perkins.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Dan Perkins, my co-host, can't be with us today, but in his place, we have what I think is an extraordinary guest to talk about a product many of us, myself included, need. Stefano Valencia is calling us from Italy. His company is developing a new product called Glucose Scanner, and we welcome Stefano to the program. How are you?
Oh, thank you, and it's a pleasure to speak with you today. I'm fine, thank you. And for us, it's night. I'm not in Italy, I'm in Japan.
Stefano, before we do anything else, like every other guest, tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay. I have a master in psychology and a PhD in psychophysiology. And that means, usually physiologists, they study how organism works in normal conditions. And psychophysiologists, they study how how organism work under, how psychological process work on a physiological level. So this is my background. I came to Japan like 10 years ago to work with Japanese government as a researcher. I worked for six years as a neuroscientist and electrophysiologist. And then I started to work for Japanese companies as R&D specialist. And a couple of years ago, I started this project, Glucose Scanner.
Well, what made you decide to go into this field and to start a company?
Okay. As explained before, I was doing, as a psychophysiologist, I was interested in emotion and psychological process. And sugar is well connected with stress, for example, and cortisol and other hormones. And indeed, actually, when people talk about glucose level in the blood glucose level, you shouldn't be concerned just people with diabetes, but it actually glucose levels can sugar in blood in the blood can tell us a lot about general information, like if someone is in pain, is under stress, is experiencing fatigue. Not just about is eating too much or is having to he needs some insulin or he needs some pills. I mean, it's if you add few information, you can get a rich image of the patient's condition. And so I was studying. Emotions, I was studying stress, I was studying cortisol and glucose levels, and I started to explore many studies and non-invasive way to check the stress and the glucose. My father got diabetes. He was punching himself, was pricking his fingers, and he was telling me, it's so painful. And this also triggered something in me. I said, why there is not a non-invasive way to do this? I mean, why they have to prick themselves several times a day, every day, 4, 5, 6, 7 times, without considering the money people have to spend. There is also actually a lot of discomfort. I would say also pain if you just constantly do that. Prick yourself your finger. So these are the reasons that make me explore possibilities of non-invasive glucose monitoring device. I was exploring devices to check stress-related conditions, and I ended to find something that could have worked well with glucose detection, glucose evaluation. So I started to follow this this path, one step after the other.
That's fascinating. You know, I'm a diabetic, and I've been one for over 20 years. But where are you now in the process of getting your product approved?
Okay, and the very beginning, because what we did so far was we are going to start some clinical trial in probably in Canada in May, and I'm in contact with several hospitals around the world, like more than 10 actually, and I wanna first do a pilot and then go with the other hospitals and collect as much as information as possible to fine tune my device and to increase the user experience. So until few months ago, we didn't have we have just hand assembled prototypes. And you cannot even start any process with a handmade prototype. So we went through several stages of manufacturing and miniaturization to get some prototype that is very close to the final product. And now, in these days, we are close to get the first manufactured prototype. So once we will have this and these matters, it will be ready in a few weeks. We will start to make our clinical trials, and there we'll start the actual procedure for with FDA for the States and for the in the other country, we will follow the standards.
Well, what does your product do that other products on the market don't do?
Among the non-invasive products, I've been testing non-invasive products to monitoring the blood glucose since in the last 2 years, and they actually tell you trends. They tell you they're already the actual glucometer, the one you have, the over-the-counter glucometer, the one you have to use every day and to prick yourself and check with chemical strips, that is not super precise, but is considered precise enough. These non-invasive devices usually are very not precise. You can just rely on them to have trends. So you can tell my glucose level is increasing or decreasing. But in the best case scenario, they overestimate the results, or they have like this. They are not never approved, really approved as glucometer. They are not considered, even if the user are satisfied, they are not considered a medical device itself. It can be considered approved or safe, the product as a gadget, but not as a medical device. So basically, to the best of my knowledge, there are not non-invasive devices that are reliable. And the preliminary results about our product show us that it could be very reliable. So this is something new. And maybe you're wondering why, what makes our product special. And I can, if you're wondering that, I can tell you that we went through the process. We actually break down the process, and we started from point zero, and from scratch we did every component and we solved any problem related to this kind of technology we are employing, that is an optical technology. We use lights, different frequencies of lights. And so we went through any kind of well-known problem related to this technology, and we were able to find our solution, our answer to these problems. So that is also what makes our product special. So nowadays, if you wanna do something like you wanna do a new mobile, what you do is just go through a list of service or functions or options that you wanna provide to your users, and you just buy modules. I wanna this and that. We didn't do that. We just built everything by ourselves. We tested everything. We want to be able to regulate, change, and control everything. And so we did this process. It was longer, yeah, but it eventually paid off, because it put us in the position to be able to control everything and to really understand what we were doing. We are a team of researchers, so what we do is we want to understand what we are doing. We are always driven by the understanding. And
well, you know, it's interesting. Let's talk about here in America. How are you going to go about getting it distributed here in America?
Oh, okay. I have no. I have some partners there. They are on the business side. I am just on the research side. We are exploring different solutions, and I cannot tell you exactly, because I don't know what will be more convenient for us and for the users. Also, because our intent, we are aiming also not just to provide a good device. We are aiming to bring to the market something that is as cheap as possible, and we want to make this not just the process of measuring blood glucose convenient and comfortable. We want to make it cheap if it's possible, because it's very, very expensive. So this is our aim, and we are exploring different solutions, and we are taking contact, and we are talking with people. When we actually are new to this world, but we are trying to create also our network. So we have been approached by some companies, and we are exploring options right now.
It's interesting. Now we have the scientists with us. We don't have the marketers. That's always interesting. If I could call you a scientist, which I think I will. Then let's go to the other side. You've developed this product. You've obviously thought about it, and to me, it's an exciting product, because every morning I prick my finger to test my glucose, and I worry about it, my A1C, like every other diabetic. According to statistics I've seen, we're about to have an epidemic of diabetic people with diabetes. It seems to me a product like your, but the other interesting thing which I found, and right, sometimes when my sugar gets out of whack, I get to, my wife says I'm not fit to be around, and I think she's right on that. Do you think a product like yours helps people better understand and maintain their equilibrium over time?
It's proved that to measure constantly glucose can help to even it helps to improve the health condition and the condition of diabetes people, but people with diabetes. But the point is, yes, I think that my device can contribute to do that, especially because it will be helpful to monitor what you eat, how it's processed. When you take a walk, how your sugar is going down. You started this question like talking about how the diabetes is becoming epidemic, and it's actually true. And it depends from what we eat. We actually eat a lot of processed food with a lot of sugars. There is sugar everywhere. In Japan, there is sugar even in the meat. I don't know in the US, but nowadays sugar is everywhere, and it doesn't help. I mean, it's actually diabetes is a degenerative disease because people keep eating sugar. If you have diabetes, you stop to eat sugar, you would feel better. So our device can help people to understand how their body processes sugar, how it's responding to different activities, and this will definitely help and improve the general health condition.
My mother had it, my aunts had it, my uncles had it, and I have it. As someone once said, it's a disease it's incurable, but it won't kill you, but the side effects. Does your product help people monitor the side effects like circulation and things like that, which are often what kills a person with diabetes?
my device cannot do anything about that. It can just tell you how your glucose level are. It just tell you the glucose levels. It doesn't control any side effects. But it's a tool in your hands, and you have to be the driver. You have to control your side effects or your health, and this is a tool that enable you to do that. Especially because you can check yourself multiple times every time you want. Now we make the process that lasts 20 seconds. It maybe will last less, but anyway, every 20 seconds you can get a measure, so you will be able to monitor exactly how it's going, your blood glucose, and how your body is responding to whatever activities or food or whatever you are doing. Is the input, and then your body process everything, and our device give you the output that tell you your glucose is going down, your glucose is going up, and this enable you to control your health condition.
We are talking with Stefano Valenzi. Stefano, do you have a website people could go to?
Sure, it's glucosescanner.com.
Can you spell it out for people? And this is radio.
GlucosScanner.com.
Well, we're going to put a link up on recalculating.biz tonight after this appears, so people can link to it. Stefano, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure for me, and I hope my pronunciation was understandable. And
you did an excellent job. Anybody listening, when you educate about diabetes, you're helping people throughout the world. Thank you so much, Stefano, for
being
with us.
That is our purpose. You're welcome. Thank you for having me, and have a good day.
You know, Dan, I've been dealing with diabetes my entire life. My grandmother had it. My mother and all my aunts had it. And unfortunately, I have it. I've had adult onset of diabetes for over 20 years. And medical science is making terrific progress in helping people understand how to prevent it, and if it does onset, how to control it. And you have some interesting information that you want to share with our audience. So
First thing I want to share is that about a week ago or so, I was also diagnosed as a type 2 diabetic, and I only have one person that I know of in my family, and that's my brother. My two sisters do not have any diabetes, but it was a scary thing to learn, because when you go to the diabetes classes at the hospitals and they start talking about all the things that can happen to you with diabetes, it's a serious, serious disease, and you can only treat it. You cannot cure it. And it really shook me up, forced me to decide to want to learn more about the disease that I had. And I found some startling information. America diagnoses 1.3 Americans every year. New patients of diabetes. we have over 30 million, almost 10% of the entire population of the United States is diagnosed as having diabetes. And the scary part is about 30% of the people who have it have not yet been diagnosed. And you were talking about diet. That's the one thing that I'm getting used to. But as I talked to the the dietitians who were teaching the classes, the incidence of adult diabetes happening into children is exploding, and the number of children in the United States that are obese and who are already now being treated not very often in the case of type 1, which is insulin dependent, but there's just an enormous number of people that are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And right now, they estimate if you're over 65 years of age, 1 in 4 senior citizens in this country will be or have diabetes, and they expect it to grow. What I found was that it was very difficult. I was bombarded with so much information over 3 nights, 3.5 hours each night. I couldn't absorb it all. And so I really felt that it was important to me to get my own education. And I'm a very task-oriented person. And I started doing my testing and got all these parameters. And you take it 2 hours after meal, and then you take it before exercise and after exercise, and you take it before you go to bed. And then first thing when you wake up in the morning. And I had great numbers after breakfast and the rest of the day. But I wake up in the morning with numbers that are not acceptable. And I've been extremely frustrated, if you would, of trying to deal with how to get those morning numbers down. So you and I had started talking to these people at Barton Publishing last fall before I was even diagnosed as a diabetic. And they have a diabetes kit, which is an instructional kit. It's done electronically. It's made in 6 sections. And we entered into an agreement with them to, because it's such an important national health issue, to promote their diabetes kit on our program and make it available through our website. So they're really addressing the 6 major issues that people have to be concerned about: diet and exercise, medicine, and a bunch of other things, so that in one easy to read place, you get an opportunity to figure out how you can begin to manage your diabetes.
Well, you know, there's so much conflicting information out there. Not so much, I think, conflicting as everybody has their own particular way of doing things. That's why I found the book extremely helpful. I've been dealing with it for over 20 years. And as you know, I talk about it at national conventions and on radio and TV, own journey. But what I found in the book interesting is that they talk about things that I've only discovered along the way, some of which I had wish I had discovered when I first became diabetic. My mother had diabetes, so the chances were 3 out of 4 that I would end up with diabetes. And
You said that your aunts had it too, and your grandmother?
Oh, well, yeah. As far back as they could go. My grandmother was an immigrant to this country, so they have no knowledge before that of her family. But my mother was, in fact, for all intents and purposes, died of diabetes, as did one of my aunts, the complications of diabetes. But, you know, for instance, one of the things that I wish I had learned much earlier, and I have to thank my wife for this, is how important it is to walk, how important it is to be out there at least, some people say 2 or 3 miles a week. Other people say it doesn't matter the distance as long as you do it every day. And the material that we're talking about, that's why you and I are pushing this so much, is because we do know the consequences of properly treating diabetes is the fact that if not properly treated, there are complications, amputation of limbs. You know, it's funny, whenever I go to my doctor, who is absolutely one of the best internists in New York City, what does he do? He goes down and he takes off my socks and checks my circulation, because that's a key element in determining what's going on with diabetes. And then again, it's the pills versus insulin and other medical remedies. I myself have not, on the occasion when I've been in the hospital, reacted very well to diabetes, to insulin. And I take pills, a combination of 8 pills a morning and 3 at night, which keeps my A1C, which is, by the way, the measure of an important thing to consider. The four byproducts of diabetes are 1, high sugar, 2, high cholesterol, 3, high blood pressure, and 4, poor circulation. Those combination of things are what kill a goodly percentage of people. As someone once said, diabetes is a disease you can't cure, but will eventually kill you if you're not careful. So I go back to you, and I can talk for an hour on the subject.
I understand. I understand. I think that the thing that shocked me the most when they told me that I was a type 2 diabetic, and as I went through all the classes and they talked about the things that you just mentioned about that can go wrong and how it can affect your longevity, I came really face to face with my own mortality, and I hadn't dealt with that before, and it was very disturbing for me. But I've settled down, and I think this program is helping me, and we hope that will help our listeners. So we're going to put a link on recalculating.biz where you can click on and go and take a look at the package, and it can be downloaded directly to your phone or your computer in an electronic file. You don't have to wait for a book to be delivered. So we thought it was an important issue, and we're spending our airtime helping you understand why it's important to get control of your health. So this is Dan Perkins.
And Don Mazzella.
Thanks for listening.
The program dedicated to American small business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz.
Marcus Lemonis, J.D. Powers, and John Scully, and 100 other presidents and experts contributed to Recalculating the Book. Why did all these people agree to contribute to the book? I'm Don Mazzella, and I'm the editorial director of Small Business Digest. And for 20 years, we have been offering small business leaders information and data to increase profits. Recalculating the Book was named the best small business book by the Independent Press Association. Whether you need help with marketing, staffing, finance, operations, technology, or many other subjects, they're all here in Recalculating the Book. They're now available at Amazon at a reduced cost. We've also created the radio program Recalculating on recalculating.biz.
Well, we enjoyed the show today, and we encourage you to go to the website, as I said before, recalculating.biz, listen to class shows. And we're also going to start giving you some heads up about who's coming in the future. And we thank you for listening, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.